The reason I switched from watercolor into watercolor was I've got a couple of very bad habits that I don't wish to pass along to other people, but I put the paint in my mouth, and I quite frequently clean brushes underneath my arm. Not only does it make for dirty laundry, but it makes the problem that those are absorption centers, and I absorb X amount of turpentine, I start getting blisters. And I've been trained as a painter since I was 8 years old. So I'm sort of like just an operating monkey of one sort or another, running on a fifth wheel. But because of that intensity over such a young period of time, I just developed an allergy to turpentine. And I found that out when I was about 23 years old, and I had to do something about it. There was no other medium except acrylics, and I didn't like acrylics. I still don't like the colors of acrylics. So I switched to watercolor. And because I had a little bit of a reputation at that time, it was difficult for me to get anyone to teach me watercolor. Because you'd go into a class and you'd get instructors and they'd sort of back off saying, well, heck, you're a professional. You don't have to have this type of training. So I learned most everything about watercolor the hard way, piece by piece. And the way I try to feed it back to anybody who asked me is much the way I got it. Through experiment and back and forth and trying and getting in and out and applying yourself and experimenting with different mediums and what happens when things happen. And I had the disappointments of finding out things that are so beautiful. I thought they're so great I had to go out and tell everybody, and I'd go to the first watercolorist I knew and he'd say something like, well, didn't you know that? I mean, that's a standard fact. But to me, it was a big trip because every time I'd find something new, it really turned me on. And you can do the same thing, but you do it on your own. And to show you some of the ways that I had to do it, I'd work at a job 8-9 hours. I'd go to school for about 4 hours, and I'd spend another 4 hours painting. And I got to a point that I needed very little sleep. And it works out great now because I can be a morning person and a night person. And I can enjoy the whole day now. So there's a great advantage. That's the reasons I got into it, is because I have an allergy to turpentine and I switched over. But because of that, I think I've developed a lot of watercolor techniques that are based in oil and oil painting, and that is to apply colors directly to the surface and work with them. Innovations, I'm not worried about purist in watercolor, I'm worried about the finished painting. So I just pass off a lot of these things that are trained to watercolorists to come along that aren't trained to oil painters, which has given me a tremendous advantage. But the advantage also that I had switching into watercolor was that I knew how to draw, and I knew how to really put things down. I had hours and hours of training in drawing, very fine, accurate, realistic drawing. Don't try to jump in and say, today I'm an abstract painter, or make excuses to your instructors and say, well, that's the way I really feel it. And that's a cop-out. And I found that out from teaching, that it was easy for me to tell a lot of people that when they come into a show and they say, well, gee, how'd you ever get that? And, well, I felt it that way. And it turns out it's a little bit of BS that you're passing on. And when I teach, I have to explain it. If you ask me, I'm going to figure out how and why I did it. And that's the way I teach right along the line. You ask me the question, and I'll try to understand why I did it. Because it makes me learn, and it makes you learn. So when you're in a class, and you put down these scribbles of lines, and you say, well, that's just the way I felt. Well, that's a nice line. But try to really understand why you felt that way. And then you start getting into the basis of the painting. I'm going to, repeat, as Ray says I don't do, a little bit of this drawing, because we do have some first year period here and some fatigue people, and it's a razor blade technique drawing that I showed to the first group that was in here, and I'll pass it along to you. Although the subject matter won't be the same, I'll try a little bit with this cow's head, show you a little bit more realistic things. The reason I use the razor blade now is that it keeps you free and keeps you moving around, and you can't get in a tight little pencil thing. Those renderings of tight little pencil arrangements are very nice and very good to learn. But if you're moving towards watercolor, you have to have something that's going to give you a broader concept of patterns and shapes and colors. So the razor blade has a shape that is very similar to many of the brushes in watercolor. So by adapting a knowledge and the use and function of a razor blade, you can apply that to the same uses of a brush later on without the problems of the color flowing in the wrong place and the wrong color coming up out of it. So that's why I get into this razor blade business. Is there any other questions before we proceed ahead with this? No? Okay. Now I'm going to do a quick little rendering of this. And you can all sit there thinking about it, because I didn't prepare the last group, but I'd like someone to come up afterwards, and we're going to do a razor blade drawing. Now, the reason for that drawing is not to see if you can draw or not, is I'm asking you just to put down a line, and I'm going to show how vivid the imagination can become off of one line. And then we'll move from that into a couple of colors and explain some of the watercolors that I use. So we'll start with the razor blade drawing. Now, this is a straight razor blade that you buy in a drugstore. Now, there is a difference between the ones in the drugstore and the hardware. The ones in the hardware have a little bit stiffer edge to them, and they can't be flexed as well. So this one can be. I use this medium quite frequently when I'm out in the field. And I'll use it on watercolor paper much as I am right now, because I can take it and then tint it. If I do a series of buildings or something and I want to check out what colors are there, rather than write down burnt sienna, rose carthium, and so forth, I'll just take it and touch it with the watercolor. Besides that, I'm not a very good speller, and I can read the colors better than I can my writing, so I will use this as a color text for it. Now, those are the first lines of the skull. And a razor blade takes a little bit of breaking in, because they're packed in an oily surface. And I'll show you a drawing I did with the first period that applied this to a vase of flowers. When you're drawing things, especially realistic things from nature, it's to your advantage to think about how they came to be and why they grew that way. And if you consider drawing them the way they were growing, such as trees grow up from the bottom, such as teeth come down from the top in this case, you'll find it easier to draw them. They'll fit together quicker. It's a very good subject to start on this close to Halloween. The little town I live in is very artist colony type, I guess you'd call it. And we're constantly into things like finding old skulls to wear in Halloween. See, there's insanity, I think, that runs among the artists. On Halloween, we all come running out down to the local pubs, and we won't leave, of course we're in full costume, until they buy us a drink. So it makes for a very good Halloween for us up there. I don't know if they celebrate it that much down in this area. Now I'm going to switch over here and throw in some gray tones. And I'm just mixing the India ink with some water. I'm going to wash some of these in and it'll move quicker. The stroke that I'm using here has been dubbed in my classes as what we call the bucket stroke. I've got a beginning for it. The reason we call that the bucket stroke is because you just put a little color on the edge, and by pulling it down this way and this way, you make a bucket. It's used by a lot of watercolorists to get behind and set off pieces of a rock or whatever you might be painting at that time. razor blade is just moving lightly across the surface. It isn't pushing down in real hard. That's why it is not cutting the surface. One of the demonstrations I do is this. You slice yourself open. Once in a while I get red mixed amongst that, but for the most part, you just keep a nice light touch to it. I don't advise you should try that, though. Not when you're starting out. That atomizer is going to give me a little bit more texture to the watercolor that I'm using, like the India ink that I am using. Anything you can learn about any medium you'll find can be applied into the one that you're terribly interested in. Now this line drawing or texture drawing can be handled over into, I understand some of you are making stained glass windows. I've used acrylic on pieces of plastic during the paintings and made some very nice stained glass window patterns. Also, you can overpaint with the India ink into the acrylic after you've got it started. And it gives you a little bit more control. Well, this fellow's getting really vicious, I'll tell you. Getting a beginning and completion of the skull. You can carry on and start putting background pieces into it. You can have them laying out in the hinterlands. I found in Montana when you're painting out in the field, you've got two great advantages. If you don't like something you put down, you cover it with a mountain or a pine tree. You get a background started in. Now we've got this one moving. Has anyone decided they're going to come up and do a drawing? Would you like to try? Would you like to try? Come on up. Get the drawing. Yeah. You've got green fingernails already, so the black won't hurt them. Just dip it in here and do a line across there.
What kind of line?
What kind of line do you feel good about? Any kind of line. Just draw something down. Just to get the feel of the razor blade. And what I'm going to do is I'll add something to the line and we'll create a painting together.
Okay.
That's a good start. That it? Okay. Now, what I'm doing here is applying just imagination to it and trying to move ahead. Now, I'm sure everyone sees something different going on that line. Imagine here, you could find the beginnings of a tree on the side of a hill. You can almost see it hanging over the edge of the cliff. And in here, I'm trying to get this out of the sun so you can see it. And here you can see how a cliff line might be coming up this way, or it could be the head and the wing structure of a bird that's flying. That's, I think, the easiest way. That comes off as a waterfall. It seems this morning I've got a thing for waterfalls. And there it is as a broken up branch, a dried twig, a weed that's laying down. Now these are things that are just in my head, and I'm sure there's 100 things in each one of your heads. So we can carry on from there. I'll finish it up and see what happens. Any preferences? Would you prefer the waterfall to the broken down tree? Doesn't matter. Okay. What I'm trying to show here is the fact that you apply your mind to it and you start to see shapes and form in it. I live my life by finding compositions everywhere I go, even when I'm looking out at you right now. And that is that I compose things wherever I am. It's just a little difficult to live with me because I'll walk out and change the things around on the table because they seem to be out of balance and I want to recompose them. So it's constantly you're composing things. I'll wake up in the morning and look at the same ceiling if I happen to be in the same place and find a new subject every morning. When I was going to school, I had about a mile to go to school, and I made it a point to compose at least 20 pieces going to school, 20 paintings possible, and 20 paintings coming home. Every day, and every day a different one. So I got to a point that I was looking at little squares this big going along the sidewalk. And all it did for me is give me a backlog of thousands of things that are in my head that I can apply now to any painting line that I see or structure that comes up. It was a very good drawing. I think I do. The only way I got through college is prior to exams, I'd read all the papers and books that were just prior to that, and I'd photograph in my head. I'd go in and pass the exam and immediately forget everything. And I think that's about what it amounted to. Because I was having too much fun doing other things. I didn't have time for all that. But it fills me with a lot of trivia also. I'll go through and read a lot of books, and I enjoy very much reading dictionaries. I find it far superior to some of the contemporary writers. No, I work from anything I can get my hands on. Nature is not the only beginning for me, but I find when I get into things that are man-made, I find that I start becoming much more abstract, because when man moves into nature, he moves in with squares and levels, and nature doesn't need squares and levels to achieve its balance. Ever noticed how when you're walking in the woods, you can instinctively see what's up and what's down? And when man puts something up and it just has to fall a little bit, it becomes so cockeyed. But in nature, a tree can be half tumbled over and still look like it's in the right place. So man always makes an abstraction of himself, it seems, to nature. So when I paint subjects such as buildings and forms, I paint them much more abstractly. No, I've never known to have preferences. It seems whatever comes up to me, I'll find. I would say that if there is a preference, I'd rather be out in the woods or in a scenery than I would in the city. Although my favorite place in the world is New York City. I think some of the best subject matters come out of that city. And I work best there, too. But I think it's more the turmoil than it is the value of the scenic views there. And it's also a city where you can't think of anything in your head that you can't find. It's also a city you can be mugged every time you walk out at night. My great advantage to that is people aren't sure if I'm the muggy or the mugger. Now, this composition's come along fairly well. Although I can't say you've done an awful lot on it yourself, but you're probably seeing the shade through it. Can you see it back there? The original line was right here. Now, the reason for that line being is it turned me on to the waterfall. If it had turned me on to a wood structure or maybe a boat sitting in a field, actually, I've never analyzed if there's a difference between a woman drawing a line or a guy drawing a line. It doesn't seem to make that much difference, but sometimes you can tell from the personalities Some will have very straight, hard lines. Others have soft, curving lines. I don't analyze or try to psychoanalyze what or why those lines are caused, but they happen to turn me on to subject matter. Say a straight, hard line would start me thinking about city forms and buildings, whereas a soft line would considered nature forms to me personally, and I'd start to relate to that and work out of it. Now this sketch I can tint, and it is drying. I'm going to show you watercolor tints. Again, because there are new people in the class, I'm going to go through this real quick about some brushes that I have here. These are very expensive brushes, but they're not necessarily the ones you have to have. The difference between these and the ones that you'll probably use is these are all red sable. And why animal hair is better than commercial hair is because there are natural pores that run through it, just like in your hair, and it holds the water and expels it on an even way, whereas the man-made products haven't made that yet. So they get a little bit, they can't run as good a line with it. It takes a little bit longer and more effort to control it as well as you do these. But they do work, and they will give you good watercolors. Now, this is an inch and a half brush, which I think is a prerequisite for anyone who gets into watercolor. Because if you want to noodle around in watercolor with little tiny things, you're going to be there forever and you're going to end up with a lot of mud. Whereas this gives you one positive line and you're finished. The 1 inch. One of the requirements that I make of my students in a class every now and again is that they complete an entire painting only using these two brushes. And that goes down to the finest detail. And because these brushes can be used in such a variety of ways, which I'll try to show you, you can do that quite easily. This is a half inch. These are all chisel edges. This is a number 12, a number 10, and a number 5. And with these six brushes, I can paint any painting you saw in that brochure or go any direction. I can go all the way up to something 9 feet if I want, although it happens that I get very large brushes when I get into that size. This is a 3-inch red sable. But I've even got them bigger than this in the studio, but I'd never use them in the field larger than this. That's why I carry it along. This only goes with me when I'm going to demonstrate, like I'm demonstrating up at Yellow Bay, and then I'll take a big brush. But in the field, I'd never carry any brushes bigger than this, and they're very functional. As far as the colors go, you can stay with permanent pigments, which are very reasonable. At the university store, they cost you about 35 cents a tube. Whereas if you move in the Winsor Newton, which is a better color, it's going to go $1.25 a tube, which gets expensive. As far as my palette, I keep the cools from the warm. That is to say, the reds and yellows and browns and alizarins at the top, and the blues and greens, and all those tones go towards the bottom. That's about all I do. They call me Mr. Mud with this. It's just a repeat again, I know, for those who've been here. It's because I keep a muddy palette. Most watercolors keep a very clean palette. I take and I'll touch the color on a white piece of paper before I get the painting with it and see what happens. The other people keep a very clean spot to work their colors in and out. I don't do that because I'm, well, a little stingy. And all those little tones laying in there can be used, and they're beautiful little undertones that can be applied. And that's coming just about to a dry. Now, if you want to stop or ask questions about any colors that I'm using or how did I get a certain shade or a certain pattern, please feel free to do so. These are just sepia umbers. And this is the way I would tint a sketch in the field. I'd decide, well, what color is that rock up there? And I'd tint this down, and this makes a note to me. So when I get back to my studio and I want to get into painting, I've got a visual note of what colors I'm interested in this, on this particular composition. Now, the method that I basically have applying to that is, as we go on through the day, those that do return, I will end up doing one complete painting. And I call myself an abstract realist. So I'll throw down 4 or 5 different colors right on the board and watch them run around. And the method that I'd use to set myself up would be to find the one point in it that I see that's real. And as soon as I find that one reality, everything else falls in place. It's like when you're I don't know if I can explain this because you might not have had the occasion, but when you're drifting in the morning and you first get up and you're not quite sure where you are, and you fix yourself on one thing in the room, and that starts to build your reality. You say, hey, I recognize that hairbrush on the dresser. And then from the hairbrush, you recognize the dresser, et cetera, et cetera. And I do the same thing in a painting, is I'll be throwing out all these colors and I'll see something happen. It might be up in the far corner, it might be down the bottom, it might be in the middle or in the side. And I say, hey, that looks like a house that I remember from maybe back in Yellowstone 2 years ago. And then from that house, I'll say, well, I also remember there were trees around there someplace. And then I'll say the ranger came out of this side. And so a story starts to build in my mind about that painting. And then I start to live that story. And then I become part of the painting. And I explain this, I'll explain it probably in every one of the classes, the groups that we have through here, is that I become completely involved with it as you would a book that you were reading. And you're creating an entire new spot for yourself. And I use this as a final statement with the last group, and I liked it, and I'm glad I got it on tape, and that is that painting to me is a very private place. And I never allow anyone in my studio to criticize my work. They can come in and see anything I do, and they're perfectly welcome, but never say a word about it. When it comes out of my studio, I really don't care what anybody says about it. But I'm looking forward to hearing them. So that during that prior time of development, I want it to be mine. So I keep it mine, and after it's developed, and I put it inside of a frame, and I hang it out someplace else, I'm real interested in what everybody says about it, because that associates me to my world. It gives me a place in this world. And I'm not worried what they say about it, because I've had my time with it, but I am interested. All artists are on ego trips, and they enjoy the compliment of people enjoying their work. And the greatest compliment being, of course, is that they buy it. That really helps everything along the line. I hope that answers you completely. In a piece like this, the way I'm working with it is just balancing color forms, because I'm not sure what I'm painting here. If I were painting it in the field, I'd be very interested in exactly the way some of these rocks and shapes were, so that I could repeat them for myself. This is that bucket stroke that I explained to you just a little while ago. And if you get some spatter in the wrong place or anything like that, you just put in a bird someplace. And when I go to the field and paint, I do all the subjects I can in the field and try to get as much reality from it as I can. And I very seldom sell or turn over the work done in the field. Now, since I've been in Montana, I've painted more in the field than I have in my entire career. I think the reason for that being is here you have privacy in the field. In the East, you never have privacy in the field. And that is that if I set up and paint outside of my town in Algonquin, by the end of the day, I'd have 10 people standing around me, and they just get in your way. Whereas here, I found that I can actually paint entire subjects, be there 2-3 hours and not see anybody, which is sort of nice. You can really get into the work. But I'm really interested in just getting an explanation of what I'm looking at that I can use for later reference when that abstract form comes up that I see. And that is the important part of it. Most of my sketches, such as this, if this were a sketch that were done in the field, it'd probably end up stapled to the ceiling of my studio. I have a studio that's about this width and about this long, and the ceilings are not quite this high, but just about this high. And that end of it is all glass looking straight out to the ocean. And the ceiling I just take and I staple up all my sketches. So it's ceiling to wall sketches and drawings as reference. And there I'll be working along and I'll look up and see something and pull it down. But I very seldom sell or use these except as reference in the field. This is what she came up with. that's just tinted with watercolor to give a suggestion of what's happening. You can pass that around. I think it's all dry, so you can take a closer look at it if you'd like. This one I'm going to show you now is putting the two mediums together, watercolor and India ink. Now I'm using a board here. I use it for all demonstration. I also use it to go in the field. It is number 112 crescent board. It is a little difficult to come by. The university store has it at a very good price. It costs approximately $4 to $5 for a sheet 30 by 40 inches, which will make 8 pieces this size. The nice function about it is, I might not be able to get into it today, is you can go on and scratch and overpaint and overscratch and pull in and push out and use gesso on it. And after you've fouled up all those mediums, you can take it and use it as a backing board for another piece. So you don't have to really throw off the piece of board. It can go on indefinitely being used. So I use it quite a bit. And in the field, it is terrific, because you can just set it down on a rock or put 2 rocks on each side, and you've got your table set up for you automatically. Now, when I put the tape around, I press down just the little edges and press in the corners. What's going to happen when I'm done with this piece, I can just pull the tape off and I've got it matted. So I don't even have to cut a mat for it. I'm just coating this out with clear water right now. There's a spot in it, so I've got to work around that spot as part of my painting. Right now, well, the spot started to turn me on. And that's a good sound for a while, but I'm into a sunset. I just threw some colors down and the sunset started to appear, and so I'm locked in already in a painting, what direction I'm going. They're the only ones. Oh, sure. One of the most phenomenal things I find in Montana is their sunsets and sunrises. I didn't paint many until I came to Montana, because it's sort of a corny thing. But in Montana, there's so much part of the entire that I've even taught some people how to paint sunsets exclusively. And the sunrises, I think, are even better. But I don't think many of you are up to catching all the sunrises. See, that's my advantage, that I'm a morning person and a night person. I get the best part of both worlds. That's a wash of 3 colors applied over. You don't have to move this rapidly with watercolor. You can move a lot slower. You can take a little bit more time to study what it is. Watercolor doesn't have to be as rapid as I'm showing it to you. I'm trying to throw out a whole series of different things to interest you in the medium, and a lot of different techniques that you can apply. All of these are based on study of drawing and line and relationship of line to them, because every stroke of color here now becomes part of the line and the patterns of the painting. You can't separate any of the works of art. They all have to join together hand in hand in draftsmanship in order to work. I'm not explaining many of the colors that I use. If you're really intent on some of the colors, I can tell you. But you'll find as you go along, you can get a lot of the colors are basic, that I can give you a list of colors that will work, that you can probably buy and put together, and you'll find a lot of nice things happening. But experimenting with the colors is very important also. Sounds like we're going to get a storm out there. That's moving with the two washes, one running up into the other, and moving very rapidly. Now, we'll try to connect the two mediums together. The one distinct advantage that you have here in Montana is your drying time is quite rapid. Now, and as opposed to the drawing with India ink, I'm using the razor blade and just pushing some of the color back out of the way. So the color has been moved in a different position by scraping it. Now I'm coming in with some India ink. What the India ink does is being placed right up next to the watercolor, it really intensifies the color that's next to it. Because the black is right next to the light tones, and you start to get a sparkle, almost like a stained glass window effect. As you go along, you'll find different ways of drawing your tree patterns and how you can establish some of the structures that you're looking for, and they've got to relate to your area. Fortunately, I've been out here in Montana often enough that I'm fairly familiar with a lot of the forms of the trees and the land shapes, whereas in New England, that's another whole thing, and I find that many people can tell the difference when you bring a painting back that it was either done in Montana or done in the New England area, which is sort of neat. Starting to get some structure forms in there. Overdrawing with the black. See if we can put some grass out there in those fields. Don't worry, it'll bring me to an early grave. All of my purchasers will be very happy. It'll all be very wealthy. It's a shame, but most dead artists are worth more dead than they are alive. Now, if that doesn't discourage you out of painting, nothing else will. The only thing I can say about living as a painter, you do live a life that is without ulcers for the most part, but with an awful lot of frustration. But the frustrations are always worked out with your ability to move around the country, and that your whole life and all your abilities are at the end of your hand, and you can carry all your tools right there at the end of your hand. So I found that a good advantage for myself many times. I've also found that there isn't any place you can go that you're not welcome as a painter, at least for the first night. I could start to get the feeling that I'm up in the Kalispell area right now, Glacier National Park. Are there any other questions that you'd like to ask about how you get started in the painting? And as I've told you, drawing is the basis of it. Excuse me? Can be very late. No, I don't believe I have. By Helena. I've been around Helena quite a bit, but I haven't been by that particular lake. I enjoy a lot of the ghost towns up in that area especially. Yes. I use a sponge. Okay, I'll use a sponge. I forgot that I just did that for a group last time too. We'll take a sponge and we'll throw in a pine tree. I'm mixing up a couple of colors into it. I'll use a lot of different things in the painting: sponges, razor blades, credit cards. There's a lot of functions for anything. It's a good recycling place. You can use it as a tool. And if you want to go look for some real good tools in watercolor, go to the local hardware store and check around. You'll sometimes find a lot of things that are there can be used. Beginning of a pine tree on one side. Also, they can be used for fall foliage. I find that any tools you use, like a sponge, if you can find a natural sponge, it's better than a commercial sponge. Just like when you're making rocks, it's better to take your hand and put prints on the texture, because in nature, at least I feel, I've found that it repeats itself, and it repeats itself in you. And the shapes and forms that you have in your body are there in nature. So if you use your hands and your fingernails to scratch out areas, to put in grass forms, if you choose that, you'll find that has a reality very similar to what nature will give you out in the field. Now, before the day's out, and those of you who are back, I want to get into painting a big rock, because I think rocks are essential to know how to paint in Montana.
Be careful of the cord and stuff around.